Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello, welcome back to the podcast, and as always, thanks for tuning in. My name is Ben Bolin. I am a video writer here at HowStuffWorks.
And I'm Scott Benjamin, the auto editor here at HowStuffWorks.com also. And today, we're going to get to a little bit more listener mail.
Listener mail. Yep. Love listener mail. Are we actually going to take a listener suggestion?
We are going to take a few listener suggestions. Once again, I did this last time as well. And I think we're going to... Yeah, we're going to answer maybe as many as three listener mail suggestions.
Okay? I like what you say, Mr. Benjamin. Yeah, you know, they used to call me Ben Multitask Bolin. So
well, I do it just to knock off some of these some of this extra work I got laying around. So this is a good way to do it. I'm going to get through to three, rid of, but you know, take care of three suggestions here.
Let's get
all
into
right, so,
it.
So from July of this year. And also from September of this year and November of this year, we had three listeners that wanted to hear about concept cars.
Concept cars.
Yeah, concept cars. And basically, all three of them wanted to know about why is it that concept cars really don't quite make it to production? Why isn't it that oftentimes they don't make it to production?
Oh, what a good question.
And yeah, I thought so too. And also why don't they make it to mass production? Why do they lose a little bit of their cool? Was another one.
Right.
So we've got one from actually, why don't they make it to production? Was from GL Man.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where GL Man is from, but it was one of them. And then we've got one from Gabriel, which is in September. And that's the one that wanted to know why they don't, or why they lose some of their cool when they finally do hit mass production. Because sometimes you see elements of the concept car.
Right.
And it looks a little bit different or a lot different.
Like you might see it on a newer model of an existing car.
Yeah. And, so that was Gabriel. And then, Deming also wrote in, and Deming said, just wants to know what our favorites are. And, isn't it a shame that they aren't really, you know, regularly produced, I guess.
Oh, it's a crying shame. Are you kidding?
I agree, because I love concept cars. And to me, that's often why I'll go to an auto show, is to see the concepts. And I think a lot of people are the exact same way.
Yeah, because you want to see the newest thing, especially when we consider, now I know I've said it before, Scott, and I hate to bring it up again, but it is true that a vehicle of any sort is a significant investment. Even if you're buying an older used vehicle, you are expecting that you will have it around for a while and you'll take care of it. And of course, everybody wants the coolest thing possible. So it's really fascinating to be able to walk into a dealership or a car show or an exhibition of some sort and see, what was the one from, I think it was, earlier this year or the end of last year, there was that concept car that had fabric covering it.
Oh, yeah.
And was able to change its shape.
BMW Gina, was it?
It was definitely BMW.
The shape-shifting car.
Oh, man.
That was cool.
That was pretty cool.
The fabric with the motion below it to did it have a top or was it the doors. I think the doors were unique, too. They didn't have any hinges. May have had hinges within, but there were no seams on the
There
doors.
Were no visible. When it closed, you couldn't see the seams.
It looked crazy. That was a neat car.
And so, I mean, I completely understand it. But again, I think, let's see, Gabriel asked, right, why these concept cars lose some of their cool when they go into production. It sounds like what actually tends to happen is that features from the concept cars make it rather than the cars themselves.
You're exactly right.
Is that right?
It's not always right, but you're on the right track here in that, it's, I guess we have to explain what concept car is. Basically.
Oh yeah. And, I'm jumping the gun.
But no, not much because, concept car, you'll hear them called show cars, you'll hear them called concept cars, you'll hear them called, prototype cars.
Right.
And maybe even there are other terms out there. I'm just like, giving you top
just
three.
Proof
here.
Of concept
or
something.
But the idea behind them is that it's a test bed for the engineers and designers in that, it allows them to get these ideas, it's a free-flowing idea. It's a brainstorm, really.
Yeah.
That, all these people get together and they decide, you know, what they're gonna build, what the purpose of this project is. We'll go through the steps in a moment here. But, once they know what that's gonna be, then they're able to really just kind of go to the outer limits of what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the cool thing about this is that when you see a concept car, you're seeing the possibly what you're going to see on real production vehicles in the future, if not the entire body, the entire vehicle, or new nameplates or badging, rather. You know, the names of cars. Let's say that, this isn't brand new, but the Mustang. Remember the excitement that was around the Mustang concept that came back? You know, the one that we see on the road now.
Right.
It looks like the throwback version, the retro version. Well, that was originally a concept vehicle in, 2005. I have it in my notes here somewhere, but,
So it actually made it.
It did. It made, actually 2003 was the Ford Mustang redesign. Mm. And, then of course there's the Camaro, which we saw recently as well.
Right. Right.
And that drew a lot of excitement. So there's, you know, it gets people buzzing about, you know, a certain product, a certain, certain manufacturer.
I'll tell you what looks like a concept car a few years ago. And I know I'm interrupting you. I am sorry, but it has to be said. The Prowler, that looks like a concept
car. It was a concept car. The Prowler was a concept car in, going down my notes, 1993.
Oh, you're good, Scott. You're good.
I got a big long list here.
But, okay.
And I don't know that you're made into production. Again, yelling at their computer screen here, but 96, right. 97, if I had to guess, 98, sure. Somewhere in there. Anyways, mid to late 90s. And again, that was just an outlandish car that people thought, you know, they would never produce this. Plymouth would never make this
right.
car. And, you know, they did it. They did. They were able to do it.
They were able to sell them,
they
too.
They did the same thing with Dodge did the same thing with the Dodge Viper. In 1989.
You're right.
Do you remember the stir that the Dodge Viper caused in 1989?
Yes, and I...
You going to tell me how old you were?
No.
You were 3?
Yeah, I was...
Something like that?
You know what? I'm going to just come clean with you here on the air. I was 34 in 1989.
Come on.
I take a lot of vitamins.
Yeah.
I exercise.
You seal yourself in Tupperware when you sleep?
I seal myself in, well, we don't call it Tupperware because it's a brand thing.
Oh, understood.
Yeah.
Airtight container of a generic sort.
Scott, there are a lot of shady people looking for people like me, you know, who age so well. So we should probably just not mention it again. And I think.
Well, you're genetic perfection.
Well, you know, I'm not genetic perfection. Let's not go too far.
If you were 34 in 1989.
Yeah.
I don't have any idea how old you'd be right now. 54.
See? You can't tell. You can't. It's surprising. This is a toupee. No, I'm kidding. But to go back to what we were talking about.
Thankfully.
Yeah. Please do. When the Viper did come out, I was actually too young to drive, and I just remember thinking it was a car straight out of a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it looked like a superhero's car.
Yeah, it was outlandish. It was a big, powerful V10 engine.
I know. I didn't even.
It was amazing. And, you know, not only that, it became production in, I believe, 92.
Right. Eventually.
And eventually, yeah. So a few years later. But it also even had, that one even spawned spinoff concept cars. There was the Dodge Copperhead, which is a very similar design. The Copperhead had a V6 engine, I believe.
Okay.
And then Copperhead never really went anywhere, didn't make it. But they did then offer a Dodge Viper that had the Copperhead package, which had the unique coloring and some interesting attributes.
Some stuff like cosmetic that. Stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The Copperhead treatment.
Let's go through, I think the best way for us to show our listeners here I think the best way for us to explain to our listeners why there is such a high attrition rate for concept cars making it through the thought process. Do you think maybe we could go through the steps of making these cars?
Sure, yeah, we can do that. And that's it's mostly it falls down to the, it falls onto this. Did I say that right? It comes down to this.
Okay.
That's something like that.
The bottom line.
Yeah, if it fails, well, then they can just shrug it off as it was a test, and you know we got some media out of it, and you know we had a vehicle in the show, and our engineers had a good exercise.
And they get information either way.
That's right. They get information either way, and maybe an element of that car is good, and it goes on. If it's applauded, if you know the media loves it, the people attending the shows love it, it draws a lot of attention. You know, it appears on magazine covers, etc.
Yes.
Then they might push forward with it. I mean, in these cars, you got to remember they're millions and millions of dollars because they're one vehicle that the company's building. It's not a cheap car to make. Any prototype, any concept car is a one of a kind, and it's all hand formed, handmade, everything. Unless they happen to be taking from another platform, like they may be using the chassis and the rolling platform, let's say the engine, the transmission, the, you know, the drivetrain from another platform vehicle that they have, and they're building up on top of that.
Which is done.
That is done often. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's because that's a time, that's a money and time saver, because mm-hmm. to develop a brand new car from scratch, it takes a lot of effort. I mean, the amount of time that that takes, by the time you got to the show that you wanted to attend, if you could make it to that show,
right?
You probably wouldn't be able to make it, because it would require so much lead-in time or lead time that you probably wouldn't make it for whatever date you're trying to shoot for, and your concept would look dated at that point.
Right.
So, you know, it's easier to start with a good base. Now, big manufacturers have an advantage there, whereas the one-off companies, you know, they have a little bit more of a struggle in being able to turn something around quickly and being able to fund this vehicle. And it's kind of their one shot and hope it works.
Well, plus also, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's, dude, you're reading my mind, because for the smaller car manufacturers, basically everything they design is going to be a concept car mm-hmm. until they can somehow leverage it into a production vehicle.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm trying to think of a good example of that. And just off the top of my head, I'm thinking of maybe Aptera. Mm. They had a vision. They had an idea of what they wanted to do. They built a vehicle. I don't have any idea what that original vehicle cost, but they were then able to shop that around to investors and, you know, make people believe in what they were doing. And now they're getting ready for production now. So you know, they're able to turn that into dollars, and hopefully they'll be able to turn the dollars into production and get the cars coming out of the door.
So technically, that's one concept car that did make it into production.
That's one, but there's several examples, but most don't make it.
Right. These are very few exceptions.
Yeah, yeah.
Generally to this rule.
Yep.
And maybe another reason why, well, here, let's talk about, we've got the steps, right?
Yeah, we got the steps here, and just kind of an order of events that kind of have to happen. I'll just give them to you real quickly and kind of a loose idea of what these involve. You got to figure out first what your audience is, what you want to achieve with this vehicle, what the goal is and what you're trying to accomplish with it.
Like, we want to sell this car to pirates.
Yeah,
only pirates.
Pirates only, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, great idea. Yeah.
Hey, maybe. Maybe this is my application for Ford right now.
Perfect. Yeah, good work. This is your best. Brainstorming. Then you go into where the group, you know, kind of mm-hmm. gathers together. We do that here for ideas for articles and podcasts, whatever. So you kind of throw around ideas and you choose whatever works the best or what everybody agrees that would be a good idea for, you know, what you decided in the first case, which is, you know, what do you want to accomplish with this design? Then you go into just a sketching phase where, you know, they draw it out either – you know, it's either on paper, it's CAD design, or, you know, it's just, there's a lot of different ways to do this now. So the sketches are the next step, because that's not terribly expensive. It's still expensive, but not terribly expensive. You got your designers working on it. This is the, and still at this point, even a lot can change. They can say, I hate that. Let's get rid of it. Let's start again. This isn't what we thought about. You know, we thought it was going to look like, scrap it and start over. Or they could say, I really like that, but change this.
Sure.
And there's a lot of that throughout this entire process. I mean, it changes, I would guess, right up until the point where they're putting together the final show vehicle.
Yeah.
The next step is a modeling stage. And the modeling stage is where they make either scale models, which can be put in the wind tunnel and tested just like a normal, you know, a full-size vehicle can. There can also be clay models, which can also be scale, which is usually what the way they do it first for this model stage. And then there's also you can do a tape model, which is a chart paper that's on the side of the, like on a wall. I don't know if you've seen this or not, maybe in photos of design studios. They have it's like a big piece of graph paper on the wall, huge. And they do a full scale tape outline of the vehicle on the wall. So you get a feel for the height of the vehicle, the dimensions of it, the way the body's going to look, but it's two dimensional. It's very flat. Again, it's just tape on paper, on graph paper. And this can be changed and moved around. So that, you know, you can decide if you want bigger wheels on that car, you want the fender flares to go just a little bit higher or lower, the roof line, everything, any aspect of that profile of the car, you can change at that point. So again, just constant change or continuous change throughout this whole process. The next step, there's only six here really, but the full-size clay model. And you've probably seen clay modeling before.
Yeah, and it's still interesting to me, though, that they do a full size in clay.
Mm-hmm. Well, the idea is that clay is easy to manipulate, easy to take away material, easy to add material.
Okay.
It's unlike, let's say, if you did it with styrofoam, mm-hmm. you know, something like that. They do that, but that's the smaller models. If you take away styrofoam, it's a lot more difficult to add styrofoam to that model than it is to add clay.
Right.
You know, I don't even know if you can add styrofoam to a model once you've done that. So, clay is just, you know, just happens to be a material that's lends itself to this type mm-hmm. of design. So, they still do full scale clay models that they then, sometimes they cover them with decals and make them look like a real vehicle for photo shoots, whatever.
Right.
You'll see them with completely blacked out windows because that's clay behind there. And the thing weighs, you know, it's sort of hollow. It's built on a frame, you know, maybe even styrofoam and wood. Kind of like a crate almost that it's built on. Mm-hmm. So it's not solid clay, but, it's very, very thick.
And then
the final car. So once they've decided that, you know, they like mm-hmm. like the design, they have to figure out how they're going to make this, bring this to reality. Because the clay is all about shaping the car and getting it exactly right. When you're actually building the car, that's when you have to get every individual piece figured out and put together.
Like that's a doozy.
Yeah, exactly. How am I going to make this this unique hood design work? How mm-hmm. am I going to make that's a great tailgate, but how am I going to make the latch that works for mm-hmm. that? Because, you know, there's going to be interference here with this glass.
And oftentimes they have to take the ideas that have never been done before, mm-hmm. and this is the part where they actually do them, where they say, okay, we are somehow going to hinge this door to this part of the car.
Exactly. Yeah, and they've got to figure out, how the heck am I going to do that? It's never been done before.
Yeah.
So the benefit of this stage now that designers and engineers have is the computer-aided design.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of different – it's not just CAD. There's a lot of other types of – there's CATIA. There's all kinds of different systems that allow you to do this digitally before you actually do a physical model. And, you know, that way you can figure out where interferences are going to happen. Let's say that hinge doesn't work right and mm-hmm. the body contacts the body in another spot. You can change that before you even make one hinge. So that, you know, it's exactly right when you build it the first time. And that's something that, you know, they didn't have in the past. Designers didn't have in the past.
Yeah, I imagine. That must have been difficult.
Yeah, it had to have been difficult. I mean, look at, we talked about the Mako Shark a long time ago.
Yes.
Remember
yes.
the 1950, I'm stretching my memory, 59 Stingray concept?
Yes.
The silver car?
Yeah.
That car, you know, of course, when they came to building the real car, that they had to build that all by hand, and they didn't have the additional help of, you know, the computer programs that they have now. Mm-hmm. So that was just trial and error until they got it right, and hopefully they got it right the first or second or third time.
And that's where the guy kept coming back and saying, no, change the paint.
No, that was actually the Mako Shark, right? That was
the Mako Shark.
Oh, did I say the Mako Shark? I meant, I guess the one that, the precursor to that. You're right. That was another concept car. That was a couple of years later, 62.
Okay.
I think it was. And, or 61. The 59 concept, I believe. I got my notes here somewhere. I've got notes.
That was the Stingray.
That was the Stingray, and same thing, Ben. Same thing. You're exactly right.
Thanks.
It was just, a lot of that became production, as we talked about with the Mako Shark. The Mako Shark. It became reality in the 1963 Corvette, and you could see it. I mean, you clearly see where that came from that vehicle. So a lot of these happen that way. The Dodge Viper is one, the Prowler is another, Plymouth Prowler. Mm-hmm. I got a whole bunch of them here. Yeah, but
let's do it rapid. I want to hear the greatest hits.
Here's some that didn't make it. I mean, there's like the 1997 Mercedes F300 Life Jet, which is a three-wheel tilting machine thing. It looked like a motorcycle kind of with a full body around it.
Oh, wow.
Let's see. There was, of course, the Camaro made it, which is now. There was the Ford Reflex in 2006, it kind of looked like a Chrysler Crossfire a little bit.
Yes, yeah.
And the second E in Reflex was a 3. Some kind of weird name, Reflex.
I remember that.
Prowler, we already talked about that. 1998, I think it was T-Rex. Was it Dodge? I think it was Dodge. Maybe.
That's the 3-wheel as well, right?
That was 6 wheels.
6 wheels?
6 wheels. The T-Rex.
Jeez.
You know what you're thinking of? You're thinking of the motorcycle car, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm talking about a truck. There was this huge truck that had 6-wheel drive.
Wow.
Two wheels in the back, and they weren't like I guess they call it a dually design.
Right.
Where they're side by side. This was one wheel in front of the other one. So if you looked at the profile, there were two wheels in the bed of the vehicle, and then one up front, you know,
in the cab area.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It was really cool. And it had, I think it was a 500 horsepower. It had a 26,000 pound towing capacity. And again, it had six wheels or three per side. So it was this enormous work truck.
It's a behemoth.
Really, it was huge. It was really huge. Of course, the Caliber was a concept car at one time, and that's kind of the next generation Neon. That became reality. Nitro was one. Magnum SRT 8 was a concept at one point.
Really?
Chrysler 300C was a concept at one point.
Wow.
I've got a lot of Chrysler here because that's the site that I went to, and I'm familiar with that brand. But Ford and GM, they have just as many. And there's, you know, concepts coming from Toyota and Honda and all over the place. Every manufacturer does concept cars. Some do it with a little more style than others. Mm-hmm. Citroen. Citroen has amazingly just beautiful concept cars. They're gorgeous, but they look so outlandish and they're just so out there that the likelihood that they'll become production is very slim. You could just kind of tell when you look at a vehicle,
right,
if it's going to happen or if it has a chance at making it or not, how close to production is it when it is a concept car?
Exactly. That's exactly it. Because I was thinking of this as well while we were talking about the different cars that have and have not made it from the limbo of concept to, you know, actual mass production. And one thing that's very interesting is oftentimes the absolute favorite outlandish, and I think that's a perfect word for it, the absolute favorite outlandish concept cars are never going to make it into production because it's a huge risk to try to, you know, to get the, let's say you threw around the number couple million, right?
Yeah. Or something like that. 15 million or something
like that. Right, because we're at a point where we're realistically not building something to sell it. We're building something to prove to ourselves that a concept works or that we can give our engineers a sandbox, really.
Sure. Yeah.
And so here's a good example. Saturn had one called the Flex. I'm sure a listener will correct me. It was like the Flex Wheel or Flex Fire or something. The main thing that I remember about this concept car is that it had a clamshell trunk. My Tennessee is coming out. And so one half of the trunk could open independently of another half.
Really?
Yes. And that's a cool idea. I loved the idea just for the ease of use. But the problem is they're never going to be able to sell that for realistically, because there are new parts that have to be involved. You know, there's
a lot of new parts.
Right. Yeah. There's not really an infrastructure for it. And every time a concept car is defeated, you know, or ends up being one of those fallen soldiers on the way to production, it's okay. Not every time, Scott. That's not fair. The majority of the time, it is because, there's not a way to produce it in a reasonable, at a reasonable price point because of the parts involved or something, or it's just too much of a risk to throw an entire factory behind it, right?
Yeah, true. And, you know, make a good point that, you know, a lot of times they do end up as these fallen soldiers on the way to production. That's a good way to say that because, the pieces may make it unattainable, maybe make it something that they just can't do. But a lot of times it's just public opinion and press opinion and, you know, just saying that I just don't like it. I just, for whatever reason, it doesn't strike my fancy, or that's a bad design because, like the one that you're describing right now, what I thought of initially was, well, there's another seam right in the middle of the car that, you know, can leak.
Right.
There's another,
it's
another thing, you know, point where water can get in my trunk. But I'm sure that wasn't the case. They probably designed it so that it was watertight. And of course, you know, that it had a good sealing system, but
sure.
I don't know. There's always going to be something that someone's going to nitpick over. And maybe they'd say like, well, you know, it's a good thought. Let's maybe let's incorporate that into a different part of the car. Like maybe we can turn that up on its side and use that for the door design.
Right.
The way they overlap or however that worked. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Public opinion plays it, you know, heavily into this.
Sure.
This is a funny example.
Yeah.
I'm almost done, really. I promise.
Oh, yeah.
In 1997.
Yeah.
Pontiac had a concept car called the Regis. Okay.
Regis.
The Pontiac Regis.
Okay.
And I happened to be there. I was at the press thing or whatever. Yeah. You know, I worked there. And one of the press people said the funniest line I may have ever heard. I still remember this all the time.
All right.
He said, because it was called Rageous because it was supposed to be outrageous, right?
Oh my gosh.
It was for outrageous, right?
Wow.
So the guy says, they shouldn't have called it the Rageous. They should have called it the Ridiculous. And I thought that was a perfect line. Like, it's like,
Ridiculous?
Okay, yeah, instead of being the Rageous, it should be the Ridiculous. You know, right away, you knew what he was talking
about. It's like that Homer Simpson card.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, the Homer.
The Homer.
The Homer, yeah, that's, it was, I don't know if the Rageous.
Was it really Ridiculous?
It was, yeah.
Wow.
It was. Whatever, I could see it when I saw it. When I was there, I saw it, yeah.
Ridiculous. That's funny.
And, you know, not to disparage them or anything. It was just another shot. You know, it's another attempt. Yeah. And who knows? Maybe there are parts from the Rageous that made it into other Pontiac production vehicles.
Right.
I just don't know because, you know, it may be something really, really subtle that eventually made it into production that people did like.
Right.
Or the design was great.
Sure.
So that happens. It happens a lot.
And that's a good positive place for us to put this because the answer to the question kind about why these cars may lose their cool, why they have such a difficult time getting to production is that they actually do make it in different parts. They partially make it because they're sort of a mixtape of concepts, you know, and some of these concepts, like some songs on a mixtape are things that people enjoy listening to or using. This analogy is confusing me. I think I'm talking myself into a corner.
That's all right. I'll get you out of it here.
Yeah. Get me out of it.
Yeah. It's true that, you know, there are a percentage of these things sometimes make it through.
Yeah.
It's not always all of them. And when you look at a car on the auto show floor, you can determine, you can almost see it. And there's some that are a little more outlandish than others, but you can kind of tell which ones are nearly production ready.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the cars, when they come out for their unveiling, some of them are pushed out. You know, they don't have an engine. They don't have an interior. They're just a shell of a car and it just rolls out. And I've seen cars pushed onto the stage before. I've seen others make it out on the stage in their own power and have to be pushed back. I've also seen them pushed because they don't have an engine. They don't have a transmission.
Right.
They don't have anything.
Just the body.
No interior, just the body. Then there's another stage where they have an interior. It looks like a real vehicle. You know, they've put their designers on the interior as well. Another good exercise for them, you know, to determine what to do the next vehicle, but maybe it doesn't have an engine. And then there's another step where it has everything. It's a fully operational concept, and it's built on another platform probably because that's a really expensive one to make right there.
Sure.
When you're starting something from scratch, unless that is going to be your next production vehicle, and this is something that you've really gotten behind with millions and millions and millions of dollars, and you know this is in development. This is going to happen.
I've got a perfect way for us to end this and maybe go into some more listener mail.
Oh, great.
Okay, so I wasn't just pulling it out of thin air when we were earlier talking about the steps to get building concept cars. Another thing that can happen that can stop a concept car from getting to production is just like you said, public opinion. Somebody who maybe has been with a concept project for 2 years or something, all of a sudden in the showroom smacks their forehead and goes, "Holy crap, pirates use boats. Why would they want a car?" You know what I mean? There's this fundamental misunderstanding of an audience.
Yes. I would hope that somebody caught that earlier, but you never know. You never know.
The Edsel.
Yeah.
Kind of flew close to the sun like Icarus.
Yeah, and, very good. Very good. Yeah. You brought it complete full circle there, Ben.
And I think
I'm impressed.
Well, thank you. I hang out with a pretty impressive podcaster that came out.
Who's that? They got some stuff you should know.
They're cool too. They're cool too. I was talking about you trying to throw a little positive energy your way.
I'm blushing.
Do you want to do some listener mail?
I would love to do listener mail.
Okay, we'll keep this pretty brief, but John from Toronto writes in and he raises some great points, Scott. He says, and I think this is more a question for you. He says, a while back we were talking about maintenance and oil changes. You talked about changing your oil every 3,000 miles or 5,000 kilometers because he's Canadian or 6 months. What's with the 6 month date? When you start to use your oil, does it start to break down on its own? For instance, if it takes 9 months to drive 5,000 kilometers, is that bad? That's what he's asking. So it sounds like he's basically asking if he doesn't drive 3,000 miles in 6 months should he still change his oil.
I've always heard 3,000 or 3 months, but that's the oil manufacturers.
That's the oil.
So, yeah, you got to take that. Also, mm-hmm. You got to read your owner's manual. It's usually a longer period of time between oil changes. But, yeah, there is a time limit. Mm-hmm. There's a mileage limit or a time limit, and whichever you arrive at first, it's like a warranty.
Right.
It's mileage or time. So yeah, if it's been 6 months, you need to get it out of there. Just clean it out because it's just, you know, the sediment or whatever. I don't know what, if it starts breaking down on a molecular level or what happens there, but, there is a time limit on it. You don't want to run old oil in a car. It's just a bad idea.
Yeah.
Really. I don't know exactly the reason why that is, why the time limit. And again, maybe it's just to sell oil. I don't know. Sure. I'm going to have to investigate that a little further. But honestly, it's always paired with a time limit as well. And again, just talk to your the best thing to do, call the manufacturer, find out what the recommendation is for the time limit on your oil, because, you know, they may say bring it in, of course, because they want to sell you an oil change.
Right. Right.
But, get a reason why. Talk to the mechanic and say, you know, why is it that I have to change it every 6 months, even if it's just sitting in my garage?
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people have weekend cars that never get to 3,000 miles in a year. And, you know, they may have to change the oil twice. It's just what you do.
That's a good point. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say that the duration of time and the distance is a lot greater if you start moving into semi-synthetics or full synthetic oils. So I'm thinking that, you know, maybe there is something with the standard organic oil that does break down a little faster than the semi-synthetic or the full synthetic oils.
What a good point.
Makes sense, right? I mean, I think you can even stretch, don't quote me on this, but I thought that I've heard numbers as high as 15,000 for synthetic oil. 15,000 miles.
What's really interesting is John also points out that he's been reading that in Europe they don't change their oil nearly as often, so it's every 10 to 20,000 kilometers.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Really? So that's 6,000, was it 6,000 to 12,000 miles?
Yeah.
On organic oil?
He does not specify the kind of oil, and I think that's what you're talking about.
I bet that oil is black when it comes out of there.
I imagine
so. I think it would be.
I imagine
so. But if they're pushing it that long, then save a few bucks.
I guess that's about it for us today. But what a good topic to leave this on. For any listeners, do you guys think that this oil thing is an exaggeration by oil companies? Do you think that it is a good idea to run a car that long without oil? Or are there any other popular rules of thumbs about cars that you would like to hear us answer?
Run it without new oil.
Run it without
new
oil.
Sorry, I had to jump in because it's a bad idea to run a car without oil anytime.
Without new oil.
I'd be real interested to know about the time consideration.
Definitely.
And, you know, why is it 6 months? Why is it 3 months? I'd be interested to know that. So if anybody knows, hit me with it.
And what's that email address?
That email address is highspeedstuff@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join How Stuff Works staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.